And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, I must have this thing. Rachel, I promise you no surprises, but Huggy Bear, our 5-time president of NAVA, Frank Waters is going to introduce you. Surprise!
I'm Frank Waters, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. I'm here to introduce Rachel tonight. I've known Rachel for 5 to 6 years now. I don't remember exactly when. It's before she came in. And she's changed a lot in the past year or so. She's gone through a lot, and she's still hanging on. She's still sticking with it. She hasn't quit yet. And I love her. I know a lot of people in the room love her. And I promised her that nobody would mistreat her from the podium tonight. So I'm not going to, and I don't expect anybody else in the room to. And you're in for a treat, I'm sure. This is Rachel.
I brought my arsenal of tissues and water and a Coke from Quick Trip in case I get bored. I'm super nervous tonight. I'm Rachel and I'm an alcoholic. Okay. So I guess I'll start at the beginning. My sobriety date is October 17th, 2010. I was born in a really small mountain town called Galax up in Virginia. And my mom, as you know, she's in the program. But anyway, I was born to her and my dad. And we moved back to Georgia when I was 2. She divorced him, which was good because I'd probably be living in a trailer, 300 pounds with 10 kids and 18 dogs. And not really, but maybe, possibly. My dad, he's a pretty rough guy. I would call a dry drunk. And I've had to go through, you know, some stuff in that arena. So daddy issues and things like that have cropped up. But he was not really there for me. He was just kind of roughneck cowboy there for himself. And so, anyway, that's about my biological dad. I'm not going to talk much about him. But so we moved back to Georgia. Well, my mom had moved back to Georgia. She moved to Georgia when I was 2. And she got remarried. And so that was an interesting relationship. I can remember some about that. What I remembered about that was my stepdad at that time, I really never felt like he liked me very much, that he probably just wanted my mom, and that created some issues. But my mom always loved me very much, and I always looked up to her, and she was always my rock. And I inherited a new brother and sister in that marriage, and they were older than me, and I always wanted to do whatever I could to be accepted by them. And so that meant cutting off my Barbie doll's hair when my brother told me it would grow back. And that and saying the F word when I was 5, and, you know, I was sitting there on the bathroom counter, you know, saying the F word, and my mom says, no, that's not what she's saying, and reading chair over here saying, yeah, I think that's what she's saying, and she asked me to repeat it, and then I got a taste of Irish Springs for the first time. And if you've never done that, that's awesome. That soap is horrible. I'm sure any soap in your mouth is horrible. So that's the kind of things that I was doing at that point in my life to feel like I needed to fit in. You know, I just wanted to be loved and accepted by everybody. I can remember being a kid always hating nap time. I hated it. I always felt like I was going to miss out on something, and that went into my adult life, too. I always feel like you're going to miss out on something. You just want to be the center of the attention, the middle of the party, just in this fantasy land, I guess, is what it was. So anyway, my mom divorced him, and we moved out, and that was pretty turbulent. We actually had to leave pretty quickly one night when they were in a big fight. And my grandmother came and picked us up, and after that, We lived with her for a little while. She was a very strong businesswoman. She had all her stuff together. She had a really nice house in Duluth, Georgia, which is where we were anyway. That's where we lived with Tim. He was in Duluth, Georgia. So we lived with her for a while, and after that we got some government funding for first-time homeowners and moved out to Auburn, Georgia, and built our first house out there, just me and my mom. And I remember hating every guy's guts that she ever dated, because if you don't know my mom, she's a very pretty woman, and she's really a go-getter, and I wanted to be just like her. In every way. So she was always the life of the party, and because of that, I kind of got this fantasy idea about, you know, what that meant to always, you know, be the wild girl. And I always wanted to be the wild girl, and I wanted to, you know, go out. I had some big fantasy about a farm party where everybody's getting drunk and around a big bonfire, and maybe you go get drunk and jump on some horse's bareback after, you know, you get into it enough. And that's just my personal fantasy. I know that all of you don't relate to that. But that's just kind of where I was, and it was a big fantasy. Then when I was 7, my mom met my dad, who she's still with now, and I do call him dad, and he is my dad, pretty much, even though I do see the other SOB in Virginia occasionally. He's been a very good example of what a father should be. That doesn't mean that I let him in right away, and I still haven't. I mean, it's hard for me. Like, I didn't just warm up to men like, oh, well, you're my new dad, I guess. It just wasn't like that. But she has been married to him for 18 years, and he's always supported me in every way I could think possible. And he's been a really good father figure. So I started getting a little bit of stability around the age of 7 and 8 when we moved from Auburn, Georgia to here. And I grew up right up the road, Briarmore Manor neighborhood off of Shalford and Briarcliff. And I was there since I was 7 and all the way up to now. I'm still living at home. I haven't been there the whole time, but I'm back there right now. So I guess at that point I just started, becoming more stable in my life. Does not mean I was doing better in school. I was, you know, in remedial reading, and I always got talking too much on every report card, K-12. I still have all of them to prove it. I always sought out the kids who were more fun in school, which was not the ones that were listening to the teacher doing whatever the teacher was telling them to do. I liked giggling and cutting up, and that's the most fun when it's in the middle of class and you're supposed to be paying attention. So I got into a lot of trouble and tried to straighten that out, and I did in some ways. But as I got a little bit older, go forward to middle school, because that's when it really all my stuff kind of started. Would hang out at Tucker Bowling Alley, which is no longer there, and me and my girlfriends, we would smoke cigarettes and do things like that, and have, you know, older friends go run up to the Happy Mart and grab us NV2020s, and that's kind of when the first experimenting stuff started. I smoked pot for the first time in 8th grade, and did something called Whippets. That's the most hardcore I'd ever got was Whippets. I never wanted to really go into the drug scene. And if any of you don't know what Whippets are, it's like nitrous oxide in a whipped cream can, and you just suck that in, and it makes you feel really weird. So that was pretty stupid. Not really proud of that. I didn't know what it was doing to me at the time. All I knew is that's what everybody else was doing around me, so I wanted to try it and have fun. Then I moved on to high school. My first drunk was over at my friend Roseanne's house, and she was a friend all the way up through elementary school, and her parents had gone out, and they went to a party, and it was probably around 8:30 at night, and we were eating some DiGiorno pizza, and we decided to get into her father's liquor cabinet, which was pretty well stocked, as I can remember, and we pulled out 3 or 4 different types of liquor, so it wouldn't be so noticeable that anything was gone. And I took a couple shots. We had whiskey out and vodka and tequila, so I, you know, not knowing and not being experienced, I took a couple shots and I wasn't feeling anything within 10 minutes. And I said, well, this isn't working, so let's take some more. And so I probably had 5 shots in a 30-minute period. And we were dancing around, goofing off, and I was sitting on her parents' brand-new leather couch. And she was up on this little computer desk up in front of me with her back to me on AIM, which was a instant messaging chat thing before texting came around. That's what we all used to do in middle school and high school was America Online chat. So next thing I know, the room starts spinning and I puke all over that beautiful new leather couch. And on top of that, my ankle was twisted because I had twisted it in cross country. So I was in an air cast, hobbling around, you know, and she had to get me into the shower to clean up the puke. I feel so bad for that. I felt bad for it the morning after it happened because she had to take care of way more than she needed to. And I dry heaved and the room spent. For at least a couple hours. And I just remember I felt like I wanted to die. I did not. It was the most horrible feeling ever. And she got me in bed, and I just sat there. She put one of my legs on the floor, so, you know, because she said that would help the room from spinning. And at that point, I didn't really give a shit, you know, after dry heaving for 10 minutes in a bathtub, freezing cold with your freaking ankle twisted and you can't hardly move and you're puking it was not pretty. So that was my first kind of real experience with getting drunk. And if I can go back for a minute, my mom came into recovery when I was 11. And I always, in high school, I enjoyed going to AA meetings with her. I really could relate to what people were saying. And she always kind of looked at me like, that's kind of scary. You can relate to what these people are saying. You know, that might mean something. It didn't surprise me because we've got alcoholism all in our family, great-grandfathers, aunts, uncles, whoever. My dad and my mom are both alcoholics. And so, anyway, I would love to go to meetings. And I got a lot of seeds planted while I was here. I did at least 2-4 steps by the time I was out of high school because I'd always go to my mom for advice. And what'd she tell me? She told me the same thing she was doing. She's like, you need to do a 4-step. I'm like, what the hell is a 4-step? So I did that on any problems I had in high school, and that was just very, very helpful. It was solution-oriented, and pretty much I was on lockdown anyway because my mom, she ran a tight show. I was not allowed to go over to anybody's house unless she knew the parents. She knew they were there. But when she went out of town, my stepdad, I always kind of played him because I knew I could get what I want. So I'd be like, oh, we're just going over here. And he'd always say yes. And so I got a few fun nights out of that. But for the most part, seeds started getting planted. And I was mostly okay in high school. I didn't have too many drunk stories. Then senior year came along, and my girlfriend, who was a good girlfriend at the time, her brother was opening Red Door Tavern down in Buckhead. And so we went and helped him set up with that, and that was pretty much like a free-for-all. We didn't have to pay for drinks. We said hey to the cop. We drank around the cop, and I mean, it did not freaking matter because we're family. So that's where a lot of my drinking started in. And that was not good because what I found was the more I drank, the more violent I got. And it wasn't to strangers. I never picked fights. I was always a wuss. Always got bullied when I was really younger in school. But I started becoming violent to, like, boyfriends, per se, or friends. I can remember one time when I turned down a shot. I was pissed. I went out to Buckhead, and I turned down a shot that this guy had bought around for this big group. And I turned it down to my friend Carolyn. She picked it up, and she took it. And I thought, God dang you, that is my shot. Even if I don't want it, you just let it sit there on the bar. I'm not having that. And I punched her. And it just wasn't good, and I felt comfortable to punch her because she was my good girlfriend, and I guess I wasn't scared that she'd do anything back to me because I knew her personality. And she didn't do anything back to me, but that's the kind of stuff that I had to deal with, my character defects coming in, my possessiveness and jealousy, and which I'd always had with my mom, but now we're talking about alcohol, you know, getting possessive over alcohol, which is, that was weird. And then possessive over boyfriends, thinking that they were flirting, or something totally stupid, like a boyfriend flirting with one of our couple friends' girlfriends. And if it was or if it wasn't, I punched a boyfriend one time really hard in the stomach, and I felt so bad for that. And that is just violent and not good behavior, and I felt so guilty for it. I felt so guilty and embarrassed the next day for that. So, anyway, moving on, senior year, get out of high school, go straight into massage school because that's my profession. Still seeking out the party girls, even in massage school where you are becoming more health-oriented whether you want to or not, like people who started off going to massage school at Waffle House every day for lunch were ending up bringing fruit for lunch by the end of the year. So whether you like it or not, you are becoming more aware when you go into an alternative health care like I'm in. And so anyway, sought out the party people again there and went to a couple little Five Points parties, a couple band parties. Those were wild. But, you know, nothing that ever made me feel great the next morning. It was all this big freaking fantasy. I'm going to go out and be the belle of the ball and, you know, flirt with the guys. And it just never turned out good. Your feet always hurt like hell by the time you got into bed around 3 or 4. Your ears were always ringing because the music was so damn loud everywhere you went. And you just felt like shit. All the next day, you'd smoke a pack of cigarettes in 30 minutes because that's just how it starts going at some point in the night. For me, it did. I just would just start chain smoking at some point. You just quit feeling and you quit being so attentive to things that you would be in your right mind. I feel like no time is going by. I'm like, come on, just go. So if I have a 10-minute story, I'm sorry, y'all. But after my college school, I moved down to Florida to be with a boyfriend that I thought that I was going to marry. And that lasted for about 6 months. I wasn't really drinking a lot during that time because he was more of a pot smoker. And I don't really care for pot that much. I just like to drink. So pretty much I didn't really continue a lot of my drinking career down there. But then I moved out of his house with him and then into a roommate's house and lived for another 6 months down in Florida. And we did some partying then with my roommate and my boss at the time, who was a chiropractor. I was employed with this chiropractor until I could get my license in Florida for massage, which is harder to do because they're covered by more insurance companies. But anyway, I think that him and his wife were probably swingers or something. There was some really interesting, and I'm not really that kind of partier. Like, I know it was all free sex and love and drugs and stuff in the 70s and whatnot, but in the 90s and 2000s, I wasn't really into all that. And it was kind of scary going out with him sometimes, because at the end of the night, Dr. Drew would be over in this corner with some girl making out, and then his wife, Joe, would be in this corner with some girl making out. And I'm like, what the fuck is going on? And it was really uncomfortable, to tell you the truth. So, and then, you know, I would go out to bars by myself. That was the first time I started doing stuff like that. You know, my roommate, Katie, she's from Canada, so she'd leave. She went to school down there, and she'd go back and visit her family. And I would start going out to bars by myself if I had no one to go with, which I didn't. And so that was a little dangerous, I can look back and say now, just knowing the kind of people I was around. I didn't know him from Adams, and I was just going to go out to the freaking, there was some country bar called the Watering Hole or something like that, and it was just a freaking good fun, but it was just a hole, you know. So that was probably dangerous in a lot of ways, and anyway, the drinking career didn't last very long because, thank God, my mom had planted a lot of seeds, like I said, back in high school about being solution-oriented, and I started becoming more and more uncomfortable with my drinking as it went on, kicking my ass more or trying to control it more or counting his drinks or her drinks or the whole bar's drinks. I count every drink that everybody had because I guess I'm OCD, or that made me feel like I was better than or less than or something. And really what got me in to the rooms once I moved back from Florida, there's a whole more drinking, and I don't want to get into all that, but anyway, you know how it goes. I decided to come in because of a boyfriend. Actually, I thought that he had a drinking problem, and I was not okay with it. And maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But instead of getting out of that relationship, I just made myself stay in it and thought, you know, I can change this. If he loves me enough, then he'll come into the program, and then we'll all be okay. And I don't have a drinking problem because I just don't. You know, I know too much about this disease. Because I did. I knew a lot about it. I like going to meetings. I've been going to meetings all through high school and all through my adult life. When I'm feeling kind of, you know, not good, I go to meetings because it feels good. You know how meetings feel. They get you out of yourself for a while. They are solution-oriented, and you feel like you can better deal with life on life's terms. So anyway, after seeing that he wasn't going to stop drinking, I decided that it was probably my problem, not his problem. And I decided to come in on Sunday, October the 17th. I came to the 11:30 meeting, and I told him that I was going to pick up a white tip. And he said, okay, I don't think you know what the hell that meant. He probably just thought it meant just for that day I wasn't going to have any beers or something. And my mom was handing out tips that day, and it was really weird. Now, that wasn't my last drink. My last drink was a couple months before. We have a good friend, Leela, who's in the program, and she was a client of mine for a while. And on the massage table one day, she called me. She was like, well, I picked up my white chip. And I thought, shit, if Leela's picking up a white chip, I can't drink anymore. There's just no way. And I used to not really like Leela very much because mom would come to school and get me drunk. She would be drunk, and then we'd be going to Leela's. I'm like, damn you, Leela, why are you doing this to my mom? You know, not realizing that it was her choice, and Leela was just a party friend of my mom's. But now I love her very much, and I'm so glad that she's in these rooms. But anyway, I don't know where the hell I was going with that. So I stopped drinking. That's right. I stopped drinking when she stopped drinking, which was late July. And then I have to think about everything until I'm sick to my stomach. So I thought about it and thought about it. Am I going to pick up a white chip? Am I going to pick up a white chip? Am I not? What does this mean? And finally, I decided to pick up a white chip. And my life has really changed around since I have done that. I'm familiar with a lot of the things that go on, but it's been more in depth since I've been in the program myself. I guess, see, I had these pieces of paper, like construction paper, that I wrote everything I wanted to talk about, and I forgot them tonight. And this is really not easy. So, anyway, y'all give me just a minute. So, how it's better is I don't, you know, I've got to look at my character defects right face to face. I don't have to have them exacerbated by, you know, becoming drunk and then acting like an asshole. I can just, you know, work on them when they come up, and I'm aware enough to do that, thank God. I don't have to punch my friends or my boyfriends or even have to make situations okay that I'm not really okay with by saying, well, screw the world, I got the bottle and a pack of cigarettes, I'm going to be okay. That's how I got sometimes. I would drink when I was mad. I would just, you know, me against the world, and I can do it all because I got my beer and I've got my pack of cigarettes. It's so self-destructive to just, you know, screw you, I'll hurt me, that kind of mentality. And I inherited that somewhere down the line, and I didn't really have to go way too far into it, thank God, to get here, because I think that I had enough seeds planted, and I had enough good example from my mom, mostly, and seeing her work with sponsees and, you know, hanging out with the sponsees and just seeing how it all works. And it is really cool how it works. I don't feel like I want to cry, Sylvester, believe it or not. Emotional parts. Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. Okay, so since I've come into the program, I have hit some really effed up emotional bottoms. I forgot about that. That's a big thing. I felt like when I first came in the program, I hit some like serious phases of depression where I felt like, I don't care anymore. What's the point of all this? Why are we here? Why do we have to do this? Why do we have to go to work to make money, to pay the bills, to keep the business, to keep the home, to keep the car? And just everything that goes along with it, you know, just totally, my depression was totally being self-absorbed. And I'm really good at kicking my own ass. And when I get depressed, I know that that is being self-absorbed. I know that that is selfish for me to even be in that state when I have so much to be grateful for. But what will happen is when I get like that, and then I start getting down on myself for even being depressed. So it's like, I lose or I lose. I'm either kicking my ass or I'm kicking my ass for kicking my ass. And that gets really old. And I've hit two sober bottoms that I can remember where I felt like I could not break out of it. And it did pass. At some point, it did pass. Thank God I didn't, you know, talk myself into going back out to drink in those processes. But sometimes, you know, there's stuff that is way uncomfortable about life, and you've got to go through it. I mean, there's no way around it. You just, you got to feel it and be okay with it or not be okay with it. Who really cares? I mean, but I really like, what Fred Hart used to say. He used to say, you'll either get through it or you'll get through it. And that is really true because, you know, no matter how much I want to make my own life a living hell, I'm going to make it through no matter what. So I might as well just take some suggestions and shut up and get to a meeting and get out of myself. Because I'll tell you what, when I was in those depressions, the last thing I wanted to do was go to a meeting. I did anything to get around it. I stayed in bed. I hid from the world. that's just how it goes. So anyway, the slogan, this too shall pass, is a good one because it always does pass. It might last a long damn time, but the more calling around you do and the bigger of a network that you have, the better it is and the better it has been for me. And it's been really hard to call people because I feel like I can take care of this myself. I'm not retarded or something. I can get through this on my own. I don't have to call for help every time, you know, I stub my toe. It's just, you know, I feel like it's ridiculous. But I've learned that I was maybe being a little too extreme in that, and that I just need to shut up and just pick up the phone and call somebody and just get some outside advice and help about the situation that I'm going through at the time. So, what's next, Sylvester? Oh yeah, and I've cried and I still cry a lot. I still cry a lot. That's what the alcohol is about. I didn't want to feel all that. I didn't want to be a crybaby. I wanted to be the girl from the mountains who'll kick your ass if you look at me wrong. And that's the truth. Like, I wanted to be a cowgirl. And I turned out to be an Atlanta girl, which is okay too. But I still like going up in the country and in the mountains and being with my kinfolk and riding four-wheelers. And I hunted deer one time. I'm never going to do that again. That was really traumatic, especially when you're doing it with your dad, who's the asshole. I guess I could go through the steps. Okay, so step one, I've heard people do this before, and I really like when people do it. They just kind of told a little bit about how they went through the steps. And so we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Their life had become unmanageable. To me, I felt like my life had become way unmanageable. When I was drinking, I didn't lose a lot of stuff. I have tons of yet. I have tons of yes. I'm 26 years old. I have to remember that I have tons of yes. When I came into the program, I thought, God, am I really an alcoholic? I might not really be an alcoholic. And it really pissed me off because then my mom would be like, well, you can go try some more controlled drinking, just like they say in the big book. And I'd be like, well, that doesn't sound fun. You know, I felt like so stuck. Like, I'm in AA now and I can't go back out. But maybe I'm just not an alcoholic. But I did feel really hopeless. No matter how much stuff I lost, I felt super hopeless when I came into the rooms. I felt like I was in a hole 6 feet deep and I could not claw my way out. I felt stuck and miserable and not in control at all of my life. So that's how step one went for me. The power greater than myself to restore me to sanity, I never had a problem with. I have never had a problem with God. I've always been taught that, you know, to have a higher power of my understanding, and I've never been fearful of God. Thank God, because I hear that that's really grueling. To have a mean God, and I'm sure that it is. I'm sure that it's got a lot of fear-based stuff to it. But I've always been cool with God and know that there is a higher power and there is a reason that things work out the way they do. So step two wasn't very hard for me either. And turning my will and my life over to Him. For me, turning my will and my life over to care of God, that wasn't that easy. Even though I trust God, I didn't have faith, which I've been told faith is just trust with a track record. And although I know God's got my back and stuff like that, like I've never really put it to the test. And God does always have your back, even though I thought I've been in control for a long time. I haven't really. I haven't really been in control of anything. And it feels so freeing now. You know, stuff like, I've got my own massage therapy business, thank God, after working for so many chiropractors and kind of came into this business. I feel like when I do a good job and I've had a good day, it's not because of me anymore. Like, before I'd be like, oh, good job, pat yourself on the back, Rachel. And now I feel like, you know what? That wasn't me. That had nothing to do with me. The fact that I had a good day, I had a good day because I was able to hand any control issues I had over to the care of God and let Him kind of work through me to help people the way that I need to help them. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory. This was scary. There was a lot of what I thought was skeletons in my closet from childhood. And my sponsor let me know that that wasn't shit, really. it made me feel a lot better because I was like, oh, my God, I cannot share this one thing with you. I just can't. I can't do it. It's too weird and gruesome and horrible. And it just wasn't. And they're like, no, that's kind of normal. I'm like, oh, thank you, Jesus. It just made me feel so much better to do that fourth step. And I know I'm going to the fifth step right now, but to admit it to another human being, that takes so much power out of everything that you have been fearful for, that I have been fearful for, that I drank over, that I have not been able to accept in myself, reasons that I've lied in the past, just knowing these little things about me that didn't end up turning out to be much of anything, is very freeing. And I have to be ready to have God remove my defects of character on a daily basis. Stuff always it has kept cropping up a lot, the character defects and issues that I deal with. And, you know, doing that spot check inventory and keeping on the, you know, the right path so I don't do a lot of damage and have to clean up a lot more shit than I feel like I've already had to do in the past. That's really important. You know, these are tools that they have been so helpful to me and have brought me out of myself. I mean, I know that I'm probably not the most humble person in the world, but I feel like I'm getting more towards that. And that feels really good because I don't have to take responsibility for stuff, because in responsibility, there's a lot of stress and responsibility. And if I can just, you know, keep giving it over and keep doing the best that I can, that's all I can freaking do. Just doing the best that I can. And on a day-to-day basis, that can look very different. Some days the best I can probably doesn't look that great. Humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. the forgiveness thing with growing up with an alcoholic parent, for my mom, that's been easier because she's made a huge living amends to me since I was 11 years old. She has only set examples for me and done the best she could, and she has been my main source of strength in growing up. My father is a different subject because I have to love him for who he is and know that he's doing the best he can too. And that's seriously where I have to get with it, where I'm in a lot of turmoil because I feel unloved, I feel abandoned, like he doesn't give a shit for anybody but himself. And that may or may not be true. You know, I can't be in his head. He was like the black sheep. The rest of that Higgins side of the family is not, they're nothing like that. My dad just, he was like the fuck up. I don't know what happened. But that was a joke. Y'all can laugh. That's not. So, I love my dad, and I know that he tries, but it has been hard forgiving someone that you do feel abandoned by, and just kind of going on and accepting them for who they are, but not putting yourself in the position to still be hurt by them. That's another big thing. Like, even though I do love him and he is my father, I don't go spend the night at his house or say, hey, Dad, let's have a movie day. You know, I don't, like, I spend a short, sweet amount of time with him, and whether he's being a butt or not, accept him for who he is, and then after 30 minutes, hi, hello, how you doing? It's like, okay, it's time to leave now. So the forgiveness thing is, it's easy and it's hard, but I know that it only hurts me to not forgive somebody, and it only makes me judge myself more, because whenever I'm better or less than anybody out there, I'm always judging myself so harshly, and I'm really good at doing that anyway, and it's not worth it to me. And that's another thing that's changed since I've gotten into the recovery program in high school. God, I was that bitchy girl that if I did not like you, like, I wouldn't be mean to you to your face, but I would talk about you behind your back, and me and my friend Gabrielle, we'd make fun of teachers, and we were just hellions. And I have really changed out of that a lot since high school, and I realized that that's just probably something that you go through. But anyway, judgment on myself has been really great all my life, and I just know that I have to be easy on everybody else, and I have to be easy on myself, or it's, you know, it's going to be a long life. All right, so the list of people that I had harmed was, Frank, what are you laughing at? It was long, but I was really relieved to know that I did not have to go and call everybody up that I felt like I had to give an amends to. A lot of them were living amends, like to my brother. I just waxed his car the other weekend. And he hasn't washed his car in like 2 freaking years. And I wanted to kill him because I cannot even get this shit out of the paint. And I'm really fanatical about cars. And so, anyway, I did that. And I didn't even ask him to tell me thank you. And I didn't use it as some kind of pull leverage like I used to when we were younger. Like, that's just how brothers and sisters are. They're really mean to each other. And, you know, I feel bad about that because I'm a sensitive person. And so, anyway, that's what that's all about. And I was just happy to know that I didn't have to, you know, go contact everybody, and that, you know, the people that were worth anything were living amends. You know, I'm making a living amends to my mom because I have done a lot of things to make her life hell in the past, and I'm sure I've worried her sick, and she never said a damn word because I was living in her house and going out to Buckhead every night until 3 or 4 in the morning. She never said a word to me about that. She would just pray and give me to God, as she says, and just hope that I came home in one piece. She never, you know, bashed me. She just let me go do what I was going to do, and I'm really sorry about that. I know that must have been pretty tough at times. Okay, I'm skipping on. Continue to take personal inventory. That's my favorite. I love 10. I love the spot check inventory. I talked about a little bit probably 30 seconds ago because this clock is not... Oh, it's moving good now. The continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I really like that one. it takes the ass kicking out of me wanting to kick my ass so much, because I know that if I'm doing wrong, I can stop and take a minute and say, whoa, chick, chill out for just a minute and see what you're doing, because you don't feel good right now, and what's the real problem going on here, and who are you being hateful and ugly to? And then I can change that around, and that's so much better than just being a bitch all day long and then feeling guilty about it all day long the next day. Sorry for the cussing. I know this will get better as I get older in sobriety. thought through prayer and meditation. I pray a lot, and I pray a lot at work, because I feel like having my own business, thank God that I have that, is all on me, and I feel like I want to do such a good job for my clients, and I feel like it's all on me, you know, and it's not. So I pray all day long, you know, God, thy will, not mine, be done, you know, guide me and love me through this process. And that usually helps me a lot. And I've had to say that some days to ad nauseum, like over and over and over, because my brain will start going back, reeling the tape again, and then I'll have to do it again. And then it just feels like I want to scream some days because I'm so in my head, and it's worse when I drink coffee. But for the most part, that has been my type of prayer. I've just had to kind of do small prayers all throughout the day to keep myself on track, and that has really helped me a lot. Meditation-wise, I've got a meditation CD, and I do not sit up with my back perfectly straight and my hands out and say, and all that. I don't care if I'm a massage therapist or not. I do it the way I want to, which is laying in bed, and usually I fall asleep, and that's okay. You know, I put on my meditation CD, and I lay down, and if I fall asleep, great. That means my brain has not been running so hard that I can't even fall asleep because I'm in obsession mode about something. So, as for now, that's my type of meditation. And spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to the alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. That's what I'm doing right now. And this has been really nerve-wracking. I'm not kidding. I was one of those kids that did not like to read out loud in high school out of a textbook from my desk. I did not like to read one paragraph. I felt like I couldn't breathe, like my heart was pounding out of my chest, and now I'm up in front of a microphone, in front of a podium, and it's almost over with. Thank you, Jesus. Because this is really nerve-wracking. I'm telling you what, to me, this is really freaking nerve-wracking. I lead meetings. I meet with my sponsor, and she's really taking me. We're going back. I just did another 4-step on the particular little subcategory of my life. And it's really good. It feels really good to know people in the program who you can relate to, and that you don't have to just be fair weather friends. You don't have to just go party and that's the only time that they're there for you. That, you know, you've got like a good strong family, and you've got steps and roots that can ground you, and just a good foundation for life. And I think that that is what it's all about here. But that's it. That's all my story. Sorry, it was short and sweet. Not much of a drunkalogue, but thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Rachel. And now for the counterpoint, Robert's going to get out of the church. Robert stepped up to the plate and told his story last Friday at 5:45. It wasn't scheduled, and I didn't witness it, but I've heard nothing but great things about it. So anybody that was there that didn't get a chance to clap for him.
Years of being a professional bullshitter pays off. My name's Robert, and I'm an alcoholic. Very good job. I'm proud of you. We have a chip system here at NABAS, do many other places. It's color-coded to mark your time, not necessarily your progress in the program. You have a white chip, 24-hour chip, a surrender chip. If you want to give up the drink and try a new way of life just for today, you can always go back tomorrow. Or it's actually, if you pick it up now, you're doing pretty good because you only got a couple more hours. 24-hour chip, white chip, once, twice, Silverchip, 30 days. Redchip, 90 days. Yellowchip, 6 months. Come on, people. Greenchip, 9 months. Any birthdays or multiple zero? Come on.
Yeah, my name's Alex, and I'm still an alcoholic. And this is kind of embarrassing to be the only one up here after this great talk. This is fabulous. I did the first. I had 10 years last Friday. And the first 8 years, I got sober in Michigan, and I was up in Ann Arbor, Michigan the first 8 years. 2 years ago, I moved down to Cape Canaveral, Florida, and now I'm back here kind of staying with my dad or close by when he's in a retirement center here. And, I did it basically by the going to meetings, going to a lot of meetings, really hearing the higher power coming through you guys at these meetings. It's really gave me a lot of inspiration. And then getting a sponsor, working the steps with a sponsor that I got up in Michigan, and being able to help some other people, just kind of getting into service. And most important is a higher power that really gave me the willingness to go on with the steps. So that's it. Thanks.
Congratulations. Anybody else? Birthday? No? We offer the white chip one more time in case you're too shy. It'll be sitting up here on the podium. Pick it up after the meeting. Give yourself a round of applause for the chip challenge.
Thank you, Robert. Helen Moore's got 47 years, and she was a young lady when she came in the program, and she shared something with me again the other day that I just love it. Do you remember what you said? Let me see if I can remind you. You had children?
Three.
And they, all right, does that tell you enough? When you're still drinking?
Oh, on my 29th birthday. On my 29th birthday, I got drunk, which was not unusual in those days. And I always, alcohol is depressing. So, of course, I got depressed, and I said to myself, Helen, old girl, here you are, 29 years old, one foot in the grave and the other on a banana peel, and the kids are growing up. They don't need you anymore. They were 5 and 3. And I didn't even have the third one. And, but anyway, things changed 6 years later, I guess. 6 years later. And when I first came to the program, I was 35, and then I fooled around a couple of years, and I've been sober for 47 years. A long time between drinks in my life.
You can catch her full story on NavClub.org. Helen M. It's about 2 years back. NavClub.org.
Time to receive the message of being free. Give me some time to breathe. It's not that I don't want to see. I misunderstood your words, to go ahead and forget my world. Oh, and I surrender, believing darkness could be a light. Oh, and I remember that all the dreams I made in the night. And I tell myself not to cry. I feel like a long lost child.